You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the controversial heir to the Saudi throne has died, but what are the consequences for the country's political future? We'll get an update from Jane Kinnenmont of the think tank Chatham House. And we'll see why the China Daily, China's biggest English language paper and government mouthpiece, plans to publish a weekly African edition from Bureau in South Africa and Kenya. Now, Vienna has made the top five in Monocle's annual Quality of Life Index, but what makes the city tick? Our woman in Vienna will join us on the line, and the city's biggest fan will be here in the studio. And the finale of the UK's Cultural Olympiad kicks off on Thursday. Monocle's Katie Bilboa and David Pleasant met Tony Hall, chair of the Cultural Olympiad Board, to hear more. All that, plus a check-in with our foreign editor in Croatia, and some music too, all here in the next hour on Midori House. But first, let's catch up with the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. Members of the Muslim Brotherhood have called for a mass protest today to demonstrate against new powers taken by the military council, who have dissolved the Islamist-dominated parliament and claiming all legislative power for themselves. Voting has now ended in the presidential runoff, with both candidates claiming victory. The results will be announced on Thursday. Greek political parties meeting today said they expect to form a coalition government soon. The conservative New Democracy leader Antonis Samaras, the winner of Sunday's election, has promised to negotiate easier terms for Greece, backed by likely coalition partner PASOK. One of his MPs, Olga Kefaloniani, told reporters that Europe needed to give Greece some room.
Well, I think that our partners must understand that they need to give us some breathing space, that reforms are necessary, but we can't work with this austerity package, which actually is keeping us in a vicious cycle of a recession.
More election news now, and campaigning for Libya's first national election in a generation has started today, ahead of polls on the 7th of July to choose a National Assembly, which will redraw the autocratic system of rule put in place by ousted leader Muammar Gaddafi. 80 of the Assembly's 200 seats will go to political parties, and the rest to independent candidates. Here, the Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has started her four-day visit to the UK on her 67th birthday. She discussed Burma at the London School of Economics, calling for a rethink of its constitution.
Unless we amend the constitution to harmonise with the aspirations of all of the people in our country, we will never be able to bring about the kind of unity and peace that we all desire. So it all comes down to rule of law.
Sports news now, and the Czech team are preparing to face Group B runners-up Portugal on Thursday in Warsaw in the first Euro 2012 quarter-final. Ahead of the game, the team are talking about the need to change the way they played in their previous game. Defender Tomáš Sivok said good team spirit was essential.
We know that they have too much quality, they are individuality players, they are one of the best on the world. So we know that we must play more like a team, not like against Russian team. Everything can happen, that we hope that this game we can win, and also we can play against Ronaldo, against Nani, and we can be successful.
Meanwhile, England will play hosts Ukraine this evening, with English fans like Mick Brooks commending Ukraine for its hospitality.
So I think it's frightened a lot of people off that Ukraine wasn't a safe place. And the fact is, you know, I found the Ukrainian people very friendly, very nice, and I've really enjoyed all the time spent here. And I will probably be coming back. I like Ukraine.
And finally, a wingsuit jumper has broken four Guinness World Records in just one leap. Jonathan Flores leapt from a plane cruising at 38,000 feet over Colombia, then flew like a human bird, reaching speeds of up to 100 miles an hour to break four world records, including longest duration wingsuit jump, lasting 9 minutes and 6 seconds. He also achieved the record for the greatest absolute distance flown in a wingsuit of 17.5 miles, and the highest ever wing suit jump. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. It's 14.05 in Rio de Janeiro, 13.05 in New York, and 18.05 here in London. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, and Tokyoist. Sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Лондонста Касин, тема он Monocle 24.
Лондонбор, это Monocle 24.
Лондон, Бургасы, Monocle 24.
Лондонист, сина Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que ninate no a Monocle 24.
Afto é Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 hardware.
And you are indeed listening to a Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. Following the death of arch-conservative Crown Prince Nayef bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud, Saudi Arabia could be at an interesting tipping point. Will the new Crown Prince be willing to contemplate even moderate reform in the oil-rich kingdom, where women are banned from driving? Will the new heir be able to win over the nation's youth, many of whom feel alienated from the inward-looking vision of a royal family still dominated by men in their 70s? Joining us on the line is Jane Kinnenmont, the Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Hello, Jane, and thank you very much for joining us. First of all, what should we not expect from a change in the who is going to be the Crown Prince? The Prince Nayef was seen as a conservative, a big supporter of Wahhabism, but will there be any real change that we'll see from the outside world?
There will be some change, but in the Saudi context, it's all relative. It's important to understand that the Saudi ruler is not an absolute monarch, although he faces few checks and balances in terms of institutions or democratic representation. He does have to balance power within his own family, and he also has to take into account that the ruling family have a traditional alliance with the conservative clergy of Saudi Arabia. So every king has a limited room for manoeuvre. They're not going to change things radically. But we did see when King Abdullah first came to the throne in 2005, some more reformist steps being taken. We also did see, since Prince Nayef became the Crown Prince, some hardening of rhetoric, a tougher line on particularly the unrest in the eastern province, which Nayef always blamed on Iran without really addressing some of the local issues, and certainly a very conservative approach to women driving and so on. So we will see a change of emphasis, but it's something that's going to be quite subtle.
Now, could you just tell me, I know it's a very complicated process for choosing who will be the new heir to the throne. The founder of Saudi Arabia had 30-odd sons, many of whom are still alive. And it's kind of passed amongst this kind of generation, isn't it? Who will be the new crown prince?
Basically, yes. The right to choose the crown prince is with the king. So they don't have a system where the king's oldest son automatically becomes the next in line. The king chooses the person, but they've always borne in mind the importance of having a family consensus. So there's always been, informally, consultations within the family to ensure that most people are basically on board with whoever is going to be the next king. Back in the past, they did have one king assassinated by a family rival. So they obviously want to avoid that kind of worst-case scenario again. Basically, back in 2006, King Abdullah formalised this consultation process. He set up a ruling family council, which will advise the king on his choice of successor. And it has a kind of constitution. There's quite detailed regulations about who sits on it and how they make the decisions and so on. So it's a very odd and interesting institution, which is just a kind of family institution, but with these kind of legalistic trappings that you would associate more with a parliament or something like that.
And can you tell me, we hinted at that at the top of the show, that perhaps some of the younger people in Saudi Arabia, a country with a massive young populace, they might be interested to see some change from a kind of generation they believe has become slightly alienated from their world and doesn't have the international perspective that many Saudis have from travelling. Do you think that there is a need for the royal family to begin to address their needs?
They will have to adapt. I think, you know, it is noteworthy that in a lot of countries in the Arab world that have seen unrest, there has been a huge difference in age between the ruler and the ruled. Having said that, the senior princes are well-educated, well-travelled, and so on. There will be some support for them among some of the younger generation. But there is an issue at this point of pure capacity. I mean, most of the sort of contenders to the throne are in their mid or late 70s. And what we've already seen in the past few years is that the capacity, the time that they have to spend on things, their ability to travel at short notice and so on is constrained. And it's in a system where in every ministry the decision making is very, very top down. So there's been kind of limits on what they can do as a result of the aging process.
Well, Jane, thank you very much for joining us today. That was Jane Kinnimont from Chatham House. You might have thought we were phoning her in Saudi Arabia, but we weren't actually. She was just out in Oxfordshire. And you're listening to Midori House.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
They say money makes the world go round, and all this week on Monocle 24, we'll be taking a closer look at the notes and coins in your pockets. From the ubiquitous dollar to the creaking euro, and taking in a few more extreme examples along the way. So tune in for The Currencies every day on The Globalist and The Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. Coming up next, we'll see why China's biggest English daily is expanding into Africa. But we're going to keep the theme a bit Saudi now, because we have a Saudi song for you. This is Asil Omran, and it's her 2008 hit, Tomani. She is a Saudi Arabian, and she's signed to Rotana, which is the Arab world's largest record label. And this is what she sounds like. And that was the sound of Asil Omran with her 2008 hit Tomani, a great Saudi singer there. Now, it's just coming up to 18:19 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House. Now, it's an exercise in soft power. the echoes of the official voice of the People's Republic of China are reaching new latitudes as the state-owned newspaper, China Daily, is set to publish an African edition as soon as October. The African operation of the China Daily will produce a range of Africa-specific content from offices to be based in Johannesburg and Nairobi. As Chinese investment and trade with the continent continues to surpass all expectations, the paper will be focusing on promoting China's interests in Africa, particularly mineral exploitation and easy immigration policies. Well, to chat about what we can look forward to, if looking forward is the right word, we're joined now by Jinghao Lu from the consultancy Frontier Advisory. Jinghao, first of all, why is the China Daily doing this?
After 2008 Olympic Games, China realized the increasing importance for itself to promote itself to the global audiences. And from 2008 to 2011, we see increasing Chinese media, not just China Daily, start launching its foreign offices all over the world. So we have CCTV, the central television, and the Xinhua News Agency, which is a state-owned agency, established its office in Africa around 2010. China Daily also launched its European branch in 2010, its American branch in 2009. So we see that because China's globally rising incurred a lot of attention and also a lot of misunderstanding over its power, it realized the importance to address these issues to the audiences who are desired to are desirous of hearing the voice from the China side instead of constantly the other Western sources. That's why now this pattern comes to Africa. China realized the importance of addressing all these issues Western criticized towards it, its land grab and labor abuse and all sorts of things. So China Daily, when we look at this newspaper, is actually the biggest English news source from China. The readership expands from the expats from the Western world in China, and also the Western scholars and the government people who have a very high interest in China. So this is no doubt the best kind of expansion that will allow China to address these global issues to the Western or the non-Chinese audiences.
Now, Jinghao, you're sitting in Johannesburg, but tell me, when you look at the South African newspaper market, it's robust, it's lively, it has great English language newspapers. Do you think really that anybody is desperate to get a copy of the China Daily in English?
Yeah, I think probably that's the largest challenge a Chinese newspaper is facing in Africa, especially a South African market with a thriving media industry. First of all, you have to ask whether or not African people really trust the news from a state-owned agency, as the continent is already hearing enough complaints and arguments from the Western media and the scholarship. And secondly, as you just mentioned, that there are so many newspapers to read, so who are actually the readership you're targeting? Are these people, are they the people who actually has already had an interest in China, or are these people just started to realize about China through reading China Daily or other Chinese news sources? So this is actually still a question China Daily really needs to address: how to enter the market, how to enter its readership.
And I often wonder, when you look at some of the operations of CCTV and other state-owned media organizations from China, they know the game, as it were. They know what they need to do, but they're not quite as successful as, say, a BBC, which may have government money behind it, but which seems more diverse in the opinions it puts across, and actually better able to often reflect the interests of local people. Do you think that these state-run organizations from China just aren't quite subtle enough in their approach?
Well, I think the question is not they're not subtle enough. It's the idea of how experienced they are in the global market. The Chinese, just give an example, in South Africa, there are probably only four journalists from a state-owned news agent, Renmin Ribao, which is the People's Daily, covering the whole continent. They have to constantly travel back and forth to different countries to cover the news. So there's certainly a lack of journalists And especially these people never been to Africa before, compared to BBC has rooted in this continent for a couple of decades. They understand what issues are. They understand how to report these to attract the audiences from these industry from these countries. But the Chinese are still probing as the other state-owned companies are probing how to do business in this continent.
And just physically, you know, is producing a newspaper and distributing is tough enough in the best of times, but distributing a newspaper across the whole of Africa, that seems to be a bit of a challenge. Do you think that they will just really concentrate on two or three markets in reality?
I think they will start with some prominent markets with good logistics, markets with good audiences. So I will identify Nairobi in Kenya, Lagos in Nigeria, Johannesburg, Cape Town in South Africa as their starting point. I certainly don't think the state agency has targeted every single country, every single small cities as their kind of major markets. So they will slowly expand. They will first regain the interest of the audiences from larger markets with larger population, with enough people who are aware of understanding China and are interested in hearing a voice from a Chinese media. So that's my point of view.
And just tell me, you know, that there have been in certain countries, you know, for example, in Zambia, there's been quite strong reaction against the Chinese presence there. People have felt that you know, Chinese traders are taking away the jobs of people in their markets. That people have felt that their governments are making deals over their heads that are favourable to China, but which actually deliver little to the people on the ground. And there has been some concern about how Chinese migrant workers are being shipped in to do special projects and then shipped out again without really kind of partaking in any of the communities where they're based. Do you think that also part of this is a PR attempt to kind of make people feel a little bit more comfortable about the way that China is doing business on the continent?
I think certainly there's a lack of a mutual understanding between Chinese and Africans. You know, the Chinese people in Africa, they also live in a very kind of separated, very isolated life. They don't really get in touch with the African people. So actually a lot of misunderstanding were generated because of that. And certainly they don't understand Africans, and Africans don't understand Chinese as well. So, you know, for example, that the Chinese or bring the migrant worker arguments, it might be true for one company in Zambia, but for so many Chinese corporations in the whole continent, this is over-exaggeration and it's over-generalization. So I think that's what exactly the state-owned media, China Daily, and also the others need to do, actually dig out these stories and say this company is doing a great job in localizing its business and employing local laborers, giving their great bonus, and this is some companies that still needs to improve. This is what Chinese can do to improve, actually deliver good media, deliver a good message to Africans and show that they care about the subject and they also understand what they are talking about. So I think it's very important.
Jinhao, just out of interest, when you're in Joburg and you switch on your TV, do you get to see CCTV?
Yeah, we do have already received CCTV 4, which is the international channel, and also CCTV 9, which is the English channel. CCTV 4 is the Chinese channel for Chinese expats all over the world, and CCTV 9 is the English channel, whose audiences are all over the world.
But there's no the content they're putting out that's aimed at, is there specific programs that you find sitting in South Africa that are aimed at an African audience?
I certainly don't think it has a specific group of people who they target to. So it's very general. It's about China and the world news all over the world.
And when you catch it, do you think it's any good, or is it as bad as, say, Russia Today?
I think Chinese media usually produce a very positive image of what China is doing overall. I think it certainly didn't have enough critique eyes through what really needs to be improved in the continent and all over the world. So.
Well, Jinhao Lu, thanks so much for joining us. That was Jinhao Lu, who works for a strategist based in Joburg called Frontier Advisory. And you're listening to Midori House.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 des.
This is Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll hear about why the city of Vienna ranks so high up on our list of the most livable cities. And our foreign editor is making his way across Croatia in shorts and flip-flops, and he'll join us on the line to explain why. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. Members of the Muslim Brotherhood have called for a mass protest today to demonstrate against new powers taken by the military council, who have dissolved the Islamist-dominated parliament and claimed all legislative power for themselves. The result of the presidential runoff will be announced on Thursday. Greek political parties meeting today said they expect to form a coalition government. The winner of Sunday's election, Antonis Samaras, has promised to negotiate easier terms for Greece. Campaigning for Libya's first national election in a generation has started today, ahead of polls on the 7th of July to choose a National Assembly. 80 of the Assembly's 200 seats will go to political parties and the rest to independent candidates. Here, the Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has started her four-day visit to the UK on her 67th birthday. She discussed Burma at the London School of Economics, calling for a rethink of its constitution. Sports news now, and the Czech team are preparing to face Group B runners-up Portugal in football on Thursday in Warsaw in the first Euro 2012 quarter-final, while England will play host Ukraine this evening. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, in your Seychelles T-shirt. Very holiday-ish. We're going to be talking about more about flip-flops and things because Steve Bloomfield has managed to get himself a trip called work, apparently, but I think he's in flip-flops myself. We'll be finding out more about that in a moment. But every day this week on Midori House, we're going to be looking at the winning cities in our quality of life issue that's just hitting newsstands. And it's going to be hitting them with a giant thump. Well, that isn't a very big thump, but I promise you, it's big and fat, and it's going to be on newsstands very soon, and it's very bright and sunny. Anyway, today we're going to put the spotlight and the sunlight on the fourth place winner, Vienna. Oh, Vienna. And in the studio now is one of Vienna's biggest fans and our design editor, Hugo MacDonald. And joining us on the line is our woman in that city, Kimberly Bradley. Hello, Kimberly, and hello, Hugo.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Kimberly. Okay, first of all, let me just look at this survey here. Now, it was number six last year, so you've edged your way up to number four. You're an American who's made their home in Vienna. What do you like about it?
I also live a little bit in Berlin, so I have a bit of a comparison.
I know. Okay, you've got
this is your chance to sing the praises of Vienna, not
yes,
Berlin.
Yes, you've got your Tyrolean hat on today. Get back down to Vienna and tell us.
I'm physically in Vienna, and the fabulous thing about it is how much is here for its size. And that's why I do compare it to Berlin a little bit, because it's got a lot of bang for the buck, if you know what I mean. There's about 1.6 or 7 million people here, but there's just incredible culture, incredible history. Things are close. It's easy to get around. And within the city, you've got like a lot of industry, a lot of very forward-thinking scientific innovation, as well as, you know, all the tourist things and vineyards on the outskirts of the city. So you can sit in a vineyard and drink wine and overlook all of this stuff.
It is the only city that has vineyards in its city limits, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Which is enough of a reason to rank it highly. But also, Kimberly, what I like about Vienna, and I'm sure we've spoken about this many times before, is the fact that it has one very strong foot in its past, which it doesn't want to give up, and it has such an incredible historic, rich history sort of in its streets and in all the buildings that are there. But at the same time, it really wants to bring in the young people and engage them with the history and the future. And Vienna Design Week is one of the best design weeks for doing that, in that they open up the workshops all over the city and engage with young designers from the rest of Europe, the sort of traditional craft that's always been done in the city, with a new generation who can sort of keep that going and keep those skills alive.
They actually, a lot of the cultural institutions are, just like you say, Vienna Design Week pairs up these young designers with traditional craftspeople who are working in glass or porcelain or you know, our favorite Markus Scher, who works with the old shoes, has also participated in Vienna Design Week. But even the museums, the Kunsthistorisches Museum, which is one of the finest museums with old masters and just this incredible collection that dates back to the imperial period, is starting a new contemporary division this year. The whole city is always kind of good at combining past and present and future in a way that seems very natural. It doesn't seem contrived.
Kimberly, can I ask you that one of the criticisms being placed at Vienna's fine doorstep in the past has been that it's not always that open to outsiders. Is that true, do you think?
To a certain extent, it is true. I mean, the Viennese are a bit closed in some sections of society just because they're Viennese. You know, there's this kind of high society that they, in any country, it's the same, and you get a bit of that here. Politically, immigration is a bit trickier than in a larger country like Germany. Yet the mayor of Vienna, for example, and he's dealing with the rest of the Austrian states, made it a priority in his last election to ease not only immigration, but integration of some of the cultures that are already living here. And so there are extra programs for kids to learn German if they're not coming from a German-speaking family. Kindergartens have been made free recently. And so a child who's like two or three can go to kindergarten completely free, learn German there. They make sure that they learn German and things like that. These are very basic measures, but it helps over the long run.
Now,
to get rid of that xenophobia from all sides.
Hugo, when you went there to make a film, which I would encourage people to go to monocle.com to view, an amazing film about apprenticeship in the city. And it hinted at something that was quite extraordinary, that there was a city which was still based around craft and making things, and it was something that young people responded to. Did it feel a bit of a time warp, or did that make it feel very contemporary?
It goes back to what we were saying a little bit earlier about the fact that it obviously has its roots in the past, but that's so relevant for today as well. And that's something that we speak a lot about in here as well, is that apprenticeships are things that just maybe seem a bit old-fashioned. But once you sort of scrap those in favour of pushing everybody through school and through university, it's very difficult to reincorporate it back into society. And Austria has one of the lowest youth unemployment rates in Europe, which the Austrians put down to the fact that they have such a strong and rigorous kind of adherence to the apprenticeship system still.
And Kimberly, could you tell me a little bit about the cost of living in Vienna? In the past, it hasn't been too bad because, you know, this was a city actually built for almost more people than are there now. It was built to be the grand capital of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. And then as that empire fell apart and Austria became a small country, it seemed to be a kind of a city almost too grand for the nation it ruled over. Does that mean that you can still get cheap apartments, you can rent in an affordable way?
Absolutely. One of Vienna's biggest secrets is that the city itself owns more buildings and apartments here than almost, I'm not 100% sure of this, but I think any other European city. They've had incredible, over decades, housing project initiatives. And you can see signs throughout the entire city, like this is owned by the city of Vienna, built in 1985, 1953, et cetera. So rent is not out of control because the city controls quite a bit more of it than it does in other cities. If I think of a comparison, I would say it's just a little bit more expensive than Berlin, which is regarded as very cheap. It's a lot less expensive than a place like Paris or London. Purchasing, I would say it's somewhere around 2,000 per square meter average.
That's 2,000 euros.
Yes, 2,000 euros per square meter is about average. And that is nice and solidly affordable for most people.
Definitely. Kimberly, if you had to throw all your eggs in one basket and give up either Berlin or Vienna, which would it be?
I have this conversation all the time with my partner. That's a really, really tough call because each city has something that the other does not. And I report from both. And so it's kind of a good straddle. I think as I get older, I shouldn't ever say that word, Vienna becomes more and more attractive, even though it's still very young. It's a nice, it's a comfortable city that's almost more Italian.
Definitely. How could you ever give up Cafe Proico?
I know. It's fantastic.
Now, I was going to ask you your top three things. So we're coming to Vienna this weekend. We really are. We're coming to stay with you this weekend. No, all Monocle 24 readers, if you want to see Vienna, I'll be putting Kimberly's address on the website later on. Okay. She does Airbnb for thousands of people every night. Now, if we were coming to Vienna, tell me three things that you would recommend that we do.
Right now, because it's so hot, it's already summer here, go to the Praterzona, which is an indoor-outdoor club in the 2nd District near the Prater Amusement Park. Fantastic. Great music. Great crowd. Cafe Poca has many, many outdoor tables right now. That's a big favorite of mine and Hugo's. It's an old-school Viennese coffee house with original interiors dating back to the 50s. Absolutely fantastic. And you can get wonderful Apfelstrudel there for very little. And sir, that's a good question. On a beautiful day like today, I would go to the old Danube. There are beaches outside. You can go to the Danube Canal and swim on the Badisches. Any of the outdoor pools I would recommend, because it's where you see the Viennese kind of sunning themselves and eating ice cream and just enjoying life.
And finally, Hugo McDonald, if you were going to be there today, is there anything else you would add to that list?
I would add to pop across from Cafe Proico, which is the cafe that Kimberly mentioned there, to the MAC, which is the Museum of... Well, I can't say it in German, Kimberly. How would you say it, MAC?
The Museum der Angewandten Kunst, Museum of Applied Arts.
Applied Arts. And in there, they have the first ever sort of social housing kitchen, which might not be to everybody's interests and one thing on the top list, but it's certainly something that I always go and see because it's fascinating.
Well, I'm
I haven't
impressed.
Sold you, have I?
No, I have sold. I'm thinking more indoor-outdoor club. I'm thinking, well, you'd have the strudel afterwards. Obviously, it wouldn't be very good to go to the club after strudel because then you might not be able to do your tanz moves. But anyway, Kimberly, thank you.
Yeah. Sorry, can I say one more thing?
You can say one more thing. Make it good.
One more thing. Okay. 19th District, any of the wineries up in the hills on the edge of town, at the end of the day, sunset, you get homemade wine by the people running that vineyard, and you just watch dusk fall over the Danube and the city. It's lovely.
Can I just say that there was an engineer slightly swooning as you spoke in German? Well, so a producer, actually. So I think you could do late night phone-ins for us from Vienna if you want as well.
Okay.
Kimberly Bradley, as usual, wonderful to speak to you, and thank you very much. And vielen Dank to Hugo as well. That was Hugo McDonald, who's our design editor and a man who has a little bit of a passion for all things Viennese, including the world of design, craft, and apprenticeships, and maybe the odd apprentice too. Anyway, so thank you very much. Tomorrow, we're going to be turning the spotlight on wonderful, wonderful Copenhagen. We're going to be finding out what the Danes have got that everyone else should have. And there's quite a few things, actually. So we might get you back for that as well, Hugo McDonald, because you're kind of like...
I'm going to be in Sardinia, I'm afraid.
Oh.
I can do it down the phone, if you like.
I think it might be confusing having you in Sardinia talking about Copenhagen. But thank you very much for coming down to see us. And
thank you.
And enjoy your trip tomorrow. You'll be glad to get that big woolly jumper off, won't you, to be in the heat tomorrow.
I know.
Good.
It's coming with me, actually. But...
Okay. you're listening to Midori House, and we're going to be right back after this.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Don't When you think of the Olympics, you wouldn't be alone if you immediately thought of athletes and sportsmen and women. But what about culture? Well, this Thursday, the London 2012 Festival kicks off. It's the finale of the UK's Cultural Olympiad, which has been running since 2008. That's a long time, isn't it? Well, for 12 weeks until the end of the Paralympic Games, there's going to be a host of cultural events happening around the country. The scale is unprecedented, featuring 12,000 performances and events across the UK, with artists from all of the 204 competing Olympic nations. At the official press launch day, Monocle's Katie Bilboa and David Pleasant met Tony Hall, who's the chair of the Cultural Olympiad Board, to hear more.
On Thursday, the London 2012 festival, the cultural festival, begins in earnest. There have been lots of events leading up to it. The World Shakespeare Festival, for example, which has been extraordinary. The David Hockney exhibition at the Royal Academy, Lucian Freud, all sorts of things have been happening. But the festival kicks off on Thursday and will run alongside the Olympic Games until the end of the Paralympic Games in early September. And to my mind, this is an amazing opportunity for us to show off the wealth and breadth of arts and culture, not just in London, but right across the country, and showcase that not only to ourselves, that's kind of important, but also to the whole world, because the eyes of the world are upon us for the Olympic Games.
And how much of the festival is about British talent, or how much of it is international artists coming over and taking part as well?
It's completely both, which represents what London and the UK kind of stands for. You know, we are a magnet for artists from around the world. We are also an amazingly artistic, cultural, creative nation. So we've got artists coming, I mean, thousands of artists taking part, coming from over 206 different countries around the world. So it's a kind of a real melting pot of art and culture in this city, which is sort of what the UK stands for, and I think that's great.
This is a really huge moment. I don't think a penny has yet dropped with the public. I think they're beginning to appreciate the scale and the excitement of the Games, but the scale and the excitement of the biggest cultural festival in our history is something that still, I think, people have yet to appreciate.
I'm Ruth McKenzie, and I'm the director of the Cultural Olympiad and its finale, the London 2012 Festival. I think it's important to remember the history here. So, of course, in ancient Greece, artists and sports people both took part in the Olympic Games, and that was taken for granted. And actually, when Baron Pierre de Coubertin founded the modern Olympic movement, he said he wanted it to be about art, sport, and education. When the UK went to Singapore to win the Olympics, because we are so brilliant at culture and creativity, as you heard the Secretary of State say, we said that we wanted to fulfill Baron Pierre de Coubertin's promise and put art back there with sport, so that we would represent the three pillars, art, education and sport.
Munira Mirza, Deputy Mayor for Education and Culture.
We're quite interested in how a city manages to kind of deliver something as enormous as the Olympic Games. So from the point of view of London governance, how has it been kind of working on this enormous project in terms of the Olympics and the festival?
The thing that London has as an advantage is that it's already got quite a good setup for holding large-scale events. So even before the Olympics was won, the Mayor of London's office was running things like the New Year's Eve fireworks, which is a massive event, 500,000 people in central London, logistical nightmare. We didn't approach the Olympics, neither the current mayor or the previous mayor, from a complete standing start. There was already quite a lot of background and work that had gone into working together. But obviously this is on a scale that's just unprecedented. I mean, it's, you know, a real challenge, because you've got a million more people expected in London over the summer. You've got massive logistical challenges. The cultural programme in some ways is the most interesting, because what we're doing is we're talking to boroughs and town centre managers in a new way. We're asking them to make their space available and to work with us on bringing artists in. And that's never really been done on this scale before.
Do you think London's always got its eye on other cities? Do you feel you're trying to compete with other world cities? Do you feel this kind of urge to show off the very best?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much competing, actually, because, I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think London is probably more advanced than a lot of other cities in terms of doing things that are outdoors and things which involve a lot of stakeholders. So I don't think you would necessarily get this programme of outdoor events in the same scale somewhere else. But actually, lots of the artists that we're working with in the festival have experienced or have worked in other cities. So Elizabeth Streb is a New Yorker Mayor Bloomberg has supported her. She did incredible things on Brooklyn Bridge. And so we've been inspired by what's happened in New York. A lot of the artists in our outdoor street festival are French or Catalonian, and they have a very strong tradition of outdoor work, partly because their weather is very good and suitable for it, but also they've just invested in that kind of artistic practice, which in Britain we tended not to do so much. So I don't think every day I have in my head a competition with New York or Paris or anywhere else, but I suppose we are looking all the time. We're kind of screening who's good and who's coming to festivals in the UK.
How important do you think it is that London has a mayoral system, and how important is that kind of mode of government been to the success of the Olympics and the Cultural Olympiad?
I mean, certainly the Olympics wouldn't have been won without a mayor. So, and that's to the credit of the previous mayor, Ken Livingstone, who championed the idea of the bid in the first place. I just don't think you could have this kind of coordination or this kind of quality if you have 33 different boroughs trying to run it. That's not to criticise the boroughs. They're very good because they understand their locality, they understand their local artists as well. But you just have a completely different profile with a mayoral system. You have the ability to invite artists who would perhaps, you know, be busy and not necessarily think of coming to London in this period, but you can invite them and they take it seriously. You can bring together the transport and the police and the potential funders. You know, we've been really fortunate in getting sponsorship for lots of the things that we're doing. You know, the Anish Kapoor orbit is the classic example of that. He met Lakshmi Mittal in Davos in the loo and asked him for the steel, and you know, it went from there. So in a way, the mayoral system has really benefited the cultural and creative industries in London. We fund things like London Fashion Week, we fund the Design Festival, we fund Film London, which is the capital's screen agency, because we can take a sort of bird's eye view of London and see that these things matter for the city as a whole, not just for the individual boroughs and localities.
That was Munira Mirza, who's the Deputy Mayor for Education and Culture here in London, talking with Monocle's Katie Bobeau and David Pleasant.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, yokoso.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. The Bropa
Jalavert. Monocle 24.
This is 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 Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Welcome back. This is Andrew Tuck on Midori House on Monocle 24. Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, a man who likes a trip, is not in the office. He's on the road. And he's on the road sort of going from Croatia to Slovenia to Italy. It's the kind of commission that you quite like to get. Mr. Bloomfield's going to join us on the line now. Steve, first of all, I was guessing you might be in flip-flops and shorts. Is that correct?
Possibly, yes, that's true. I'm speaking to you from the ramparts of Trsat Castle, overlooking Rijeka, a small town in northwestern Croatia, which is right on the Adriatic coast. So I've got quite a lovely little view out over the Adriatic. You can see the port, you can see the town, the mountains behind us, and yes, the sun is still shining, and yes, I am in shorts.
Well done. Now, you're there because, well, it's a bit of a kind of busy season for publishing for Monocle. We've got the Monocle Quality of Life survey issue that's just about to land on newsstands, but we're also working on Monocle on Med, our Mediterranean newspaper, and you're there for a commission for that. You're going to be driving along Europe's shortest coastline, aren't you, over the next day? So that'll probably take you about 15 minutes.
We are indeed, yes. I think I've already done far more driving today, just getting from Zagreb to here, than we're going to do when we actually sort of go into Slovenia. Slovenia's got just 46 kilometres of coastline. It's the shortest coastline, they say, in Europe. And there's also, I mean, obviously, you know, everyone knows what's happened here over the past 20 years or so. There's a lot of very recent and very raw history, and that still plays a part now. Where I'm going tomorrow, the Bay of Piran has been disputed for many years between Croatia and Slovenia, and that dispute held up Croatia's accession to the EU. That appears now to have been sorted. We'll be going to Piran to see what it's like and to just really sort of get a sense of what things are like on both sides of the border.
Now tell me, the Slovenes, were quite lucky as it went, the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. There was very little fighting there, very little trouble. They managed to kind of break away and set up a country that's really kind of seen as a bit of a Switzerland of the region, a country with great democratic institutions, a thriving economy. But across the border in Croatia, things have been a little bit more complicated. Do you sense any of that, or is it really just a country making money from the tourist trade at this time of year?
Well, it's certainly making money from the tourist trade. Certainly if our flight in on EasyJet coming from Gatwick to Zagreb was anything to tell by. I mean, it was, you know, utterly packed. There was only one seat spare, and this is, you know, this is June. So they certainly seem to be doing quite well. A lot of the hotels seem to be doing well. We made a little trip to the beach for reporting purposes earlier, and can report that, you know, the beaches are filled with people enjoying the sunshine. So I think it's, you know, Croatia certainly had not as easy a time as Slovenia had. Slovenia's civil war lasted 10 days. Croatia's was obviously far longer. But it certainly, you know, appears to be a country that's sort of on the rise. And, you know, as I say, now they've sorted out this dispute with Slovenia, they'll be joining the EU very, very soon.
And at the moment, are they members of the Eurozone, or are they using the euro as a kind of a secondary currency, or are they still kind of going their own way in currency terms?
They are still going their own way. I have a wallet full of kuna, K-U-N-A, which we've been using here. And then when we cross the border, it's a very good question what we'll be using in Slovenia. I don't think they use the euro, but I'll be able to report back tomorrow with more currency news.
Now, what's also interesting is that you're going to end up in Trieste, and we were just talking to Kimberly Bradley up in Vienna, and this part of the world has been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's changed back and forth and is now an Italian city. And I guess it'll be interesting again just to see, you know, how this kind of tiny strip of coastline, how varied and how much it changes as you go along.
Well, indeed. I mean, yeah, some of the places we're going to tomorrow, hopefully by the end of tomorrow, we'll be in Koper in Slovenia. Koper's been run by the Venetians. It's been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's part of the Yugoslav Empire. It was ruled by Italy at some stage. So it's, you know, you've got all these little towns and mini cities on this coastline that have been fought over, often quite fiercely, over the past several hundred years. And it's only really been recently that they've become quite settled, and yet obviously they still have, as I'm sure we're going to discover, sort of a lot of those traits that they've picked up. Those things don't disappear.
Well, Steve, thanks for joining us. Now, we're going to catch up with you again tomorrow. If we phone you tomorrow night, where will you be? Will you be in Italy or in Slovenia?
We'll be in Slovenia tomorrow. We're planning to be in Piran, which is the bay that was where there was a big dispute between Slovenia and Croatia. So that's certainly the plan.
Okay, well, Steve, thanks very much, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next is the news. After this news, apologies, is this week's episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald, where Monocle's Kimberly Bradley, she's back again, explores the latest art and design from Design Miami.
This is a balancing piece I've made. It's all balancing in the center on a sharpened steel tip. And one person sits on either side, similar to a seesaw. And the power of your breath is enough to spin you around in circles.
Now, don't forget, if you've missed any of our programmes or just want to hear something again, you can hear everything on iTunes or via our website, monocle.com. Andrew Miller will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.